Lawsuits are in the news all the time, but a couple of Oregon environmental lawsuits have made headlines a number of times in recent years because they are filed on behalf of children against government entities in an effort to force government to take action on climate change, which figures to affect the children's futures. The suits are just one portion of a much larger body of environmental law, and the University of Oregon is very much involved in that realm of law. The law school at the U of O includes an Environmental and Natural Resources Center. Mary Christina Wood is the faculty director of the ENR Center, as it's known. She's been our guest before. She'll be in Ashland this week to talk about environmental law and the children's suits, and she joins us now. Mary, good to have you back on The Exchange.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Let's start really broad. I mean, how long has there been an ENR at the University of Oregon Law School? And even more broadly, how long has the field of environmental law even existed?
Yes. Well, to answer the second question first, environmental law really started in the 1970s with the passage of major statutes like the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. And very soon after that, University of Oregon began a curriculum in environmental law and then a world-renowned conference for public interest environmental law. And we've had a formal program now for about 15 years. So we're nationally ranked, and we try to really stay on the cutting edge of laws that develops, and it's developing very fast now.
I kind of figured that was what the history was like, you know, around the time of the passage of things like the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act. Before those laws were on the books, what kind of legal recourse did people have if their neighbors polluted a stream or something?
Most people resorted to nuisance lawsuits, but those are problematic because you have to bring a lawsuit every time there's harm. So the environmental laws were supposed to really resolve a lot of the problems.
So has there been a shift then from suing the people doing the harm to the environment to suing the agencies that should be stopping the harm to the environment?
Yes, that's exactly right, because the environmental laws have nearly across the board failed in their major objectives to resolve environmental problems. The environmental problems are getting worse, not better. There are many things that have, you know, gotten better. There's people don't dump garbage in the rivers anymore, and the rivers don't catch on fire. But now we face climate crisis, of course, and carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases are simply not regulated yet under the Clean Air Act.
That's a fairly strong statement, though. Did you say that the environmental laws largely failed in their major objectives?
Well, the Clean Water Act was supposed to clean up rivers and actually expire the permit system by about 1987. And so the permit system was supposed to be a temporary system to phase out pollution. And instead, the agencies have continually administratively extended permits and then allowed more permits to pollute. And so while the problems aren't as obvious as dumping garbage in rivers, there's pollution in every water body in the United States, and sometimes very severe pollution, even in water bodies that you wouldn't expect. And so environmental law has not achieved its purpose of cleaning up the rivers, the air, and so forth. The major problems now somehow escape effective regulation, and climate crisis, of course, is one of them.
That's a really interesting thing, though, that you say the permit system was supposed to be retired about 30 years ago, the idea being that you give people permits for what, like discharges into of wastewater and of pollutants into the air, and they can't go over those limits?
Well, the Clean Water Act set up what's called the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System. And so these permits are called NPDES permits, but focus on the word elimination. They were supposed to be phased out. That's right there in the statute. And they weren't because, and it's easy to understand why. Once you start issuing permits, industries start lobbying the agencies, and then they also contribute to gubernatorial campaigns, presidential campaigns, legislative campaigns. And it wasn't long before the regulated industries really began to have influence in the agencies. And the agency officials had trouble stopping the permits.
Well, let's skip straight ahead to the current day then. And when the agency we're talking about that's at the center of all this is the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. And the person in charge of the EPA is a former attorney general in Oklahoma who sued the EPA on a number of occasions. I mean, was there a general sense of logic there within the environmental law community about whether logic is or is not being applied?
Well, this happens with certain administrations. It happened with the Bush 2 administration. It's happening now, where the president appoints what I call political operatives to head up the agencies. And these political operatives typically come from the very business that was regulated by the agency, and they bring a hostility to that regulation and sort of a mission to eradicate some of the regulatory authority within that agency. So logic or not, I mean, the logic is to undermine the agency's ability to regulate. And so that's even on top of the problem I just mentioned, which is more systemic, that the agency culture is very difficult to deny permits once they've gone on for a while.
Environmental law is the subject matter here on the Jefferson Exchange. Our guest is Mary Christina Wood. She's the faculty director of the ENR Center. That's the Environmental and Natural Resources Center at the University of Oregon School of Law. So a broad field to talk about here. You can join us as we talk about environmental law and its application, or if you see it that way, as misapplication over the years. Phone number here is 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. At any point has Congress put any pressure on the EPA to end the permit system, the NPDES system we were just talking about, because it was supposed to stop 30 years ago now?
Well, no. In the last couple decades, Congress has really played an absentee role. When it has intervened in environmental law, it's really exacerbated the problem by passing appropriations riders which constrain the ability of agencies to regulate. So many listeners probably remember the salvage rider. The salvage rider was an appropriations rider, which is a piece of legislation tacked onto an appropriations bill, and it suspended all environmental laws that applied to forest sales for a year.
For timber salvage, which is hence the name salvage rider.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Congress has not been helpful in this regard, and it has utterly ignored the biggest crisis we face now, which is climate crisis.
You know, I've often wondered about those things like the salvage ride. I'm glad you brought that up because, the reference from the environmental community was it was the rider from hell, stuff like that. There have been several different versions of that over the years, and it gets back to something that I came to know as sufficiency language when I was reporting on this, that Congress essentially says that we're declaring in this legislation that the activities going on are sufficient to meet the intent of the law, which sounds like Congress is essentially making a judicial kind of ruling on legislative matters.
Well, they call it sufficiency language because that's less of a hot-button name for it.
Mm-hmm.
But what they're really doing is suspending environmental laws for a year, however broad their sweep is. And with the salvage rider, it was incredibly broad. It was suspending virtually all environmental laws for a year. And they may call it sufficiency language because that really doesn't sound so bad. It sounds like the rider just declares things sufficient. But for the public should know that the senators that typically push these riders are heavily funded by the very industries who benefit. So it's not exactly a declaration that things that the new situation will meet environmental standards. It's really more of a waiver for the industries that are funding those particular senators.
And so you really have to, in environmental law, keep an eye, it sounds like, on the political realm as well, because this is never just purely law, is it?
Well, it's all law, but there's three branches of government, and you have to keep an eye on all three at once. So we have courts, we have the legislature, and we have the executive with all the agencies. And any time there's some sort of advance in one, there's pushback in the other branch. So a really good environmental lawyer has to keep an eye on all three branches at once and understand how not only how all of them work, but how all of them interrelate and the appropriate checks and balances between the three.
Which makes me wonder if you instruct students at ENR to take a number of, if there are some political science requirements for the program.
Yeah, we talk a lot about policy. So we teach law and policy because environmental law is constantly moving forward to address or not address. Sometimes it's obstructed, but in any event, life doesn't just stop. Change occurs, and so we're constantly keeping our eye on policy as well as law, and policy being the new changes in society that necessitate legal reform of some sort.
Mary Christina Wood, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She is the faculty director of the Environmental and Natural Resources Center at the University of Oregon School of Law. She'll be in the Rogue Valley in Ashland on Thursday of this week for an evening session called Nature's Trust, Our Children's Trust, a Climate Forum on Litigation to Save the Future. brought in by the ECOS Sustainability Resource Center at Southern Oregon University and the League of Women Voters. That is Thursday night at 6 at the Rogue River Room of the Stevenson Union on the Southern Oregon University campus, which is a long way of saying you can actually talk to Mary Christina Wood now on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 about environmental law. Comments and questions also welcome via email at jx@jeffnet.org. So let's talk about some of the more recent developments in environmental law and this use of the public trust doctrine to sue governments for not taking action on climate change. I know you probably could get tired of reminding people what the public trust doctrine is, but would you give us a primer?
Sure, I really never tire of it. and the short version is the public trust is a very ancient principle that goes back to Roman times, and it's very logical. It just says the government is a trustee of our crucial natural resources that we need for our survival. And so you can imagine all these resources that we need for our survival, like the air and the water and wildlife and shorelands and so forth, held in a trust where government is trustee and the citizens are the beneficiaries. So this isn't something, you know, modern lawyers dreamed up. This is part of our legal tradition and has been so since the inception of this nation. It's also in the legal tradition of countries around the world. And that's really not surprising because it goes back to Roman law, and it forces government to protect the resources that citizens need for their survival. So in this country, the principle allows citizens to go to court, and when the governments are not protecting the crucial resources or giving them away to private interests when they shouldn't, the citizens can sue and enforce the trust obligation. So it's a paramount obligation and is constitutional in nature, meaning that it is really the bedrock foundation underlying all of the statutes, because the legislature itself, both on the federal and state levels, the legislature is a trustee. And so it is held to this principle that is so ancient, it really is part of the sovereignty of a nation and a state.
Has it been used more frequently in environmental law in recent years?
Yes, absolutely. And the interest now is surging because the Trump administration is seeking now to eradicate much environmental regulation, particularly in the climate area. And so when Trump administration does that, and the Bush administration sought to do the same thing, you really have to look outside the statutory law to find any sort of protection for these resources that we rely on for our general survival and welfare. So the public trust is outside of statutory law. It's the foundation of all statutes. And there is enormous interest now and lawsuits now filed on behalf of children and youth across this country and also increasingly in countries around the world suing governments for failure to take action on climate crisis.
And the organization at the center of this is Our Children's Trust, based in Eugene. Are you connected to them directly?
No, I'm a professor at University of Oregon, but my work is all about the public trust doctrine and what I call atmospheric trust litigation. So I write a lot and speak a lot in this area. But I'm not an attorney in these cases. Our Children's Trust is the organization that spearheads this litigation. And they have a landmark federal case in the Federal District Court of Oregon, and then cases in other states in this country. And also, they just filed a case in India, I think a few days ago, which is huge, challenging the India government's failure to address climate crisis.
So are there a bunch of other countries as well where atmospheric trust litigation, or ATL, is going on?
Yes, if you go to the website of Our Children's Trust, actually they have a whole page on global actions, and global actions are being planned or have started in a multitude of countries. So I think each page tells you the status of the lawsuit or planned lawsuit, but the countries include Pakistan, Uganda, South Africa, I believe, England, Germany, Australia. You know, they're very diverse countries, Philippines, and now India, Pakistan. So listeners can learn more by going to their website.
And that's our Children's Trust. So it, let's talk about atmospheric trust litigation, or ETL, a little more about the way it's worked so far, because it seems like it had a hard time getting traction in the courts in Oregon. Is it just too alien to judges, or just too easy to dismiss as some sort of legal novelty or something?
Well, the trial court here in Eugene found that the first time around, the first time the case came up, Judge Rasmussen said this really isn't a job for the courts, it's a job for the legislature. And, of course, that's true. The problem here is that the Oregon legislature has not addressed climate change in any comprehensive way, and states across the country have the same problem. So atmospheric trust litigation seeks a remedy of forcing the agencies to create a plan for reducing carbon dioxide emissions according to scientific standards. So initially, the round of atmospheric trust litigation encountered this reaction from courts that, hey, this isn't our problem, it belongs to the legislature. And then courts began to realize the all-out, mind-blowing urgency of this crisis, and that we just don't have time anymore. We don't have decades left. We don't even have many years left to bring society back from the tipping points that we face right now. And so more recently, there have been many victories in atmospheric trust litigation in Massachusetts, in Washington, in Pakistan, in the Netherlands, but most fundamentally right here in Oregon, in what is called the biggest case on the planet, the Federal District Court of Oregon declared a constitutional right held by youth to, and really all citizens, to a stable climate system under both the public trust doctrine that I've described and also provisions in the U.S. Constitution, including the Due Process Clause. So that is enormous and groundbreaking, and it really didn't happen a moment too soon. And I think that decision will have quite a bit of influence and provide momentum to the movement as a whole across the country and the world. Now, for the Oregon case, so there's two cases. There's a federal case in Oregon, which mm-hmm. I just described.
That's Juliana versus case. Trump now?
That's against President Trump and the agencies. And then there's a Oregon-specific case, which is now sitting in front of the Court of Appeals of Oregon, and that body has not yet made a decision in this case. It's a case appealing Judge Rasmussen's, actually, second decision.
And that's Chernag versus Brown?
Yes.
Okay. So federal case and state case separate. All right. So when is trial expected on the federal case?
The judge indicated that trial would be either late summer or in the fall. And so right now the parties are going through discovery, which is really an amazing process. It means a lawyer asks for documents from the other side. Sometimes they depose people that they want to actually question in person. And the youth plaintiffs have actually asked for a deposition of Rex Tillerson, Secretary of State. And it appears that can happen, not today or tomorrow, but at some point down the road.
Wow. So I wonder what kinds of reactions you get from within the legal profession. And Googling the cases, I did end up at the National Review Online, which had nothing but ridicule for it.
The what?
The National Review Online. Not surprised. A very conservative organization. But I just wonder what the general reaction in the legal community is to the use of the public trust doctrine in this way.
Yeah. Before the Trump administration, I think a lot of people, even before the Trump administration, a lot of people were seeing the futility of staying completely within the statutory system, because there simply is not enough bureaucratic momentum and energy to tackle the problem of climate change according to on the scale it needs to be tackled. And so law professors all across the country were starting to teach this and everything. Now that the Trump administration has come in, it's sort of deemed the last law standing, because the Trump administration is resurrecting fossil fuel projects around the country, is undermining all of President Obama's late-term climate initiatives, is wants to withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement. And so now, with the Trump administration dismantling statutory law and regulatory law, and asking Congress to dismantle some statutory law, the public trust is a constitutional measure or constitutional source of law is really all that stands between Trump and runaway climate heating in terms of the legal approach, because there's simply not anything in regulatory law of significance that President Trump is not undermining the climate area.
Is there an assumption that public trust is always part of law, or is it specifically spelled out in the Constitution?
No, many of our constitutional rights actually are not spelled out in the Constitution. The right to marry, for example, is the most recent declared right by the Supreme Court, and there's no language in the Constitution about that. So courts have looked to the fundamental rights in the Constitution and then have elaborated on those rights as they pertain to modern society. And so the public trust actually has, you know, many iterations in the letters between Jefferson and Madison and so forth. The founders obviously thought long and hard about the endurance of the nation, and the public trust is part of the legal history of our nation because it came from England. But like many other rights, it has no specific definition in the Constitution itself.
Mary Christina Wood, you can hear the sound of the break coming. I wonder if I can take like another 3 minutes on the other side of the break. Do you have the time?
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll take a short break. We'll come back and talk more with Mary Christina Wood, who is the director of the Environmental and Natural Resources Center at the University of Oregon School of Law. This is the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with her and take maybe a phone call or an email from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. .836 on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We have a fascinating conversation about environmental law going on with Mary Christina Wood, who is the faculty director of the ENR at the University of Oregon Law School, ENR being the Environmental and Natural Resources Center. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. So we've been talking about the public trust doctrine and its use in these lawsuits on behalf of children, in that the government is not upholding the public trust by maintaining the atmosphere in good shape for future generations. And it's going on all over the globe now. How different is it to sue a government entity to get it to do its job versus doing a job badly?
Well, that is a distinction. It's easier to stop projects from going in as opposed to forcing government to create a plan and carry it out. However, injunctive relief, that's what it's called, allows courts to force action or stop action. So that's part of the traditional mix of powers that any court has and has had since the beginning of our nation.
You mentioned very briefly when we were first talking about environmental law and the growth of it and, of course, the creation of the unit at the University of Oregon School of Law. You mentioned the Public Interest Environmental Law Conference, which I noticed is about a month behind us now in early March. How much has that grown over the years?
Well, from the early years, it's grown substantially, but it's pretty much stabilized about 3,000 participants, I think, coming from around the world to our law school. It's, you know, it's widely deemed as sort of the event for public interest environmental law, and a lot of ideas get formed there and, I think, infuse various initiatives worldwide.
That's what I wanted to circle back around to ask if the idea of using the public trust doctrine for children's climate suits arose out of a public interest environmental law conference.
No. It arose out of my scholarship, actually. When Hurricane Katrina hit, I was writing about the public trust, and I hadn't focused on climate much at all. I was one of those who kind of ignored the problem, thinking it was so long-term. But I started reading Dr. Jim Hansen's work. He was then head of the Goddard Institute for Space Studies at NASA, and I was shocked by what I read in the scientific papers and literature, and I thought, how could I have really missed this? Or not paid as much attention to it, because I'd never seen such mind-blowing urgency. And so my first thought was environmental law will never address this in time. The standard Clean Air Act processes. And people at EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, were telling me that there was such resistance, political resistance, to regulating greenhouse gas emissions that they didn't think it would happen in time either. And so I saw this as a perfect application of the public trust principle, because it's very logical. The government has to protect those essential resources for our collective survival. And it was just readily applied. So I wrote about it and published a couple chapters and books, and then started speaking about it. And 3 years later, Julie Olson, who is executive director of our Children's Trust, heard me speak about it and took up the idea and formed the organization to actually spearhead these lawsuits around the world.
So what would be the result envisioned for these lawsuits if they're successful? I mean, are we talking about a Clean Air Act on steroids? I mean, much greater restrictions on greenhouse gases, stuff like that?
Well, it's up to government to decide. It's up to the executive branch to decide what to do to reduce carbon dioxide emissions. So all of the lawsuits and administrative petitions, too, ask for a plan that's enforceable to reduce carbon dioxide emissions according to the scientific trajectory that is established under best available science. And so it's really up to the agencies and the legislatures to determine how do you bring down carbon dioxide emissions enough and with the speed required at this point in time. It goes far beyond the Clean Air Act, really, because the Clean Air Act just regulates sources of emissions. And what government needs to do right now is to really kick in and change the infrastructure to allow the growth of a renewable energy economy. And the Oregon legislature right now, as a matter of fact, is looking at climate legislation. This is its third time. It's kicked the can down the road time and again with the climate crisis. And now, for the third time, it is right now looking at legislative packages to bring down carbon emissions in this state and to invest in renewable energy. Had these legislatures acted back in 2005, we would have only had to reduce 5% a year to bring about a stable atmosphere by the end of the century. Now that figure has gone up to 8% a year. So there's a huge risk and danger in delaying any further, because according to James Hansen and his scientific team, if we wait even until 2020 to reduce carbon dioxide emissions, we have to reduce 15% a year on a global level. So it's gone up. Our job, our trajectory of reduction has gone up from 5% in 2005 to 8% today to 15% in just 3 years. So there just cannot be any more delay.
All right, so the longer we wait, the bigger the effort has to be to curtail what's going on.
Yes, and at some point it becomes not feasible. But the other thing that listeners should bear in mind is we're facing mind-blowing tipping points right now. The permafrost at the northern latitudes is melting. If that really goes, we could go straight into runaway climate heating, because the northern latitudes holds carbon dioxide and also other greenhouse gases. And when they melt, they emit to the atmosphere. Some people call it a potential atmosphere tsunami. So the point is that nature has its own processes that can drive runaway heating if we push nature too far. Then feedback loops kick in, and then we lose control over the situation. We are right at that point now where we have to pull back from this climate cliff, so to speak. Because if we take more steps in that direction, we lose control over the climate future.
Let's take one call here. We have Rika in Grants Pass on the line. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to The Exchange with Mary Christina Wood from the University of Oregon.
Well, good morning, Jeff. Mary?
Hi.
Public interest law can only apply if the government can actually change the situation by the proposed solution.
Okay.
And the proposed solution, reducing CO2, it's not been proven that CO2 actually causes warming, you know, a whole lot of warming of the atmosphere.
Well,
and the thing is, it's only 400 parts per million. That's 0.04 of a percent of the atmosphere at this point.
When lots of studies indicate 350 was a good place to stop, we're already over 400.
Well, the thing is, in the last 250 years, going from 280 to 400, it's only risen 12 thousandth of a percent as a portion of the atmosphere.
Okay, so
we're talking trace gas warming here, and that's the biggest trace gas.
All right, so let's get a response from Mary Christina before she has to go about how to approach that, particularly when you have Rika and many people like her saying that this isn't as big a problem as we're making it out to be.
Yeah, so I'm not a climate scientist, and so I defer to the climate scientists on this matter, just as if I were a patient with a medical problem, I would not try to diagnose it myself. I would go to the best doctors or try to find the best doctors. And in this case, the doctors for the planet are the best available climate scientists, and there is unanimous understanding that carbon dioxide does raise the temperature of the planet. And so while I understand some listeners may find that hard to believe, it is the conclusion of the scientific community. And moreover, they say that we have to pull back now because this so-called, you know, the layer, if you will, blanket of carbon dioxide emissions is not allowing the energy to escape into space. And so it's almost like blankets being piled up on a bed. And, you know, if we have blankets on a bed and we get too warm, we throw them off. Or if we are in a car and it gets too hot with the windows rolled up, we roll the windows down. There's simply no way to do that with the planet. So the scientists are absolutely screaming out danger at this point.
Well, thanks for giving us an extended look at what goes on with environmental law as relates to the Children's Trust lawsuits that are being filed not just in Oregon and not just in the United States, but in other countries around the world. Mary Christina Wood is the faculty director of the Environmental and Natural Resources Center at the University of Oregon School of Law. She'll be in Ashland for a session on Thursday evening, 6 to 8, called Nature's Trust, Our Children's Trust, a Climate Forum on Litigation to Save the Future. That'll be in the Rogue River Room of the Stevenson Union at Southern Oregon University. Mary Christina, good to talk to you again on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be on the program.
All right, take care.